Welcome to Entrepreneurship with Peter Christo. Today, I interview Professors Jason Potts and Darcy Allen from RMIT's Blockchain Innovation Hub here in Melbourne, Australia. Jason and Darcy are thought leaders in the decentralized space and contribute their insights to help not only entrepreneurs seeking to solve problems, but also the development of educational content for the university, along with assisting regulators in coming to terms with this emerging space. Jason and Darcy offer important insights into blockchain and how it is emerging as the new frontier of entrepreneurship and innovation. Please join me as I discuss all things blockchain, crypto, and innovation with Professors Jason Potts and Darcy Allen.
Okay, well, so let's just go with it.
It's recording fine, so.
No worries.
All right, if you can tolerate it, let's crack on.
Yes, absolutely.
All right,
well, I mean, I don't need double Jason in my life, but at this point, that's fine.
I don't know him well enough to tease him a bit like that. So, look, welcome to both of you, Jason and Darcy. It's only the second time we've met, but I feel like I already know you. Thank you for doing this. And Jason, I think you this is your first day back too, isn't it?
No, this is first week back.
Oh, it's first week back.
We gradually dribble into work through January.
Oh, very good.
The
very
clothes good. Slowly get more formal as the month goes on.
Technically, first day back doesn't start until after Australia Day. But
yep.
We like to pretend.
Nice. Look, I'm pretty pumped to have you guys on board. As I said, you know, my heart belongs to, obviously, you know, deal in innovation entrepreneurship, but my heart belongs to blockchain and particularly the finance side of crypto. So maybe we just open this up by each of you introducing yourselves and then talk a little bit about RMIT's innovation hub, the blockchain innovation hub, and we'll kind of kick off from there. What do you say?
Sounds good. I'll jump straight in. Look, thanks, Peter, for having us. This is always a pleasure to do these sorts of things. We've been looking forward to this. So I'm Jason Potts, Professor of Economics here at RMIT University. I've been here for 12 years or so, and we started the Blockchain Innovation Hub, I'd say 6 years ago. Does that sound right, Darcy? That's
2017. We're now 2024, so it's all a little bit confusing.
Many cycles ago. We started it back at a point in time where it seemed like it just a completely crazy thing to do, because, you know, part of it was what's blockchain. But our initial insight was, so we're sort of a bunch of business school types. There was about three of us initially, and then Darcy was sort of came in very, very soon after we started. But we're sort of business school types, economists, lawyers, accountants, and so on. And we've been playing around with this new technology. And especially in your PhD, Darcy, that was right where this a lot of this started. We've been playing around with very early stage new technologies, and we're doing 3D printing and cryptocurrencies, whatever they are, and a few other things. And what our interest was about the nature of entrepreneurship and innovation in very, very early stage technologies. And we're interested in how do you find out business models? How do you figure out what type of things to do with this? Just really wanting to dig into a very particular type of fast-moving, not even patented type technologies, and crypto was just one of the ones we had on our list. We got obsessed. We got utterly, utterly obsessed with that. Went down that rabbit hole. Have found more rabbits than possibly anyone else. But it was that initial just trying to understand very, very early stage innovation around very, very new and weird tech that was fast moving that got us obsessed with this. So we started Blockchain Innovation Hub then, that's where sort of 6-7 years later. But just to sort of leap ahead a little bit, the thing we're obsessed with now is Gen AI for exactly the same reason.
Right.
So we're sort of this rapid, fast moving new tech that's just sort of appeared seemingly from nowhere and is disrupting everything. And we're obsessed now with just how you build new business models out of that. What does it mean to try and, you know, what trying to understand the nature of entrepreneurship and innovation in that space. So, you know, we're still blockchain innovation hub. We're still completely in that world.
But I guess I can, you can bring the two together. You can conflate the two. Absolutely. Yeah. But look, I'll let Darcy introduce himself too. I think we'll circle back on that, because that's a deep dark rabbit hole that I'd love to go down.
Fantastic. It's great to be here, Peter. Thanks for having me. My name's Darcy Allen. I'm an academic economist, just like Jason. I'm the deputy director of the RMIT Blockchain Innovation Hub, but it's also part of this broader research program into entrepreneurship and frontier technologies. And just to go back to what Jason said, back in 2014, 2015, we were looking at a whole range of different technologies and the entrepreneurial communities that emerged around them. Blockchain really stood out to us at that point in time. And that's why we got obsessed with it and went down a rabbit hole. And it stood out because blockchain itself is quite a different type of technology to those other technologies that were mentioned. So there are industrial technologies like 3D printing or lasers or drones, and they help us to do physical things faster and better and cheaper and so on. Blockchains are not an industrial technology, they're an institutional technology. They're a technology of governance and rules and trust. That's why they're so hard to understand, but we were a team of institutional economists. And we see the world, and what we see is we see institutions, we see firms, we see governments, we see clubs and commons and all these rules in an economy, and we think they're critically important. And then in 2008, 2009, here's a new technology of rules that doesn't happen very often. So we just went straight down that path of, we saw the value in it very, very quickly, because I think we were predisposed almost of our view of what an economy is and what a society is, for why this tech might be so disruptive. So that gives a little bit further background to how we got here.
Look, that's extraordinary. So am I right to assume neither of you come at this from, you probably have an appreciation of technology and some capabilities, but you're not technologists per se. Would that be fair to say that?
Yeah, we're economists.
Yeah. It's interesting because I would class myself in the same way. So I'm a business guy, but I was always the guy that the engineers could understand. Or I can understand the engineers, so or tolerate their personal habits, right?
There's this stage of a new technology, right, where we have the tech and the tech works, and we're looking around going, well, what do we do with it now? It's not clear often when that new tech emerges what we do with it, and the entrepreneurial process is going from that tech invention through to, okay, business model, application, how does it work in practice, all of that. And we're still seeing that in blockchain at the moment. We're still figuring that out through the booms and the busts and the cycles of whatever's big each year, which is really exciting.
So let's just get something out of the way first, if I may. We all talk about this rabbit hole, and I have an opinion in terms of what that rabbit hole looks like. And in my view, you know, you've got to be a little bit of a techie. And if you get the tech, or you come in through the lens of tech, then you might bump into economics, and then you might bump into finance and how money works, and then you might bump into how regulators and the power structure operates not only between governments and, you know, between businesses how would you characterize this elusive rabbit hole that keeps sucking us in? Either of you, you're welcome to have a crack.
It's chaotic. Whatever it is, it's chaotic, and it's different for everyone. It depends what you're building in many ways, or what you're interested in. So one of the things that we do at the Blockchain Innovation Hub is we have a lot of startups walk through the door who have very early stage startups who might have an idea, might have a potential application that they want to use crypto or some other tech for. And the rabbit hole that they go down from there is very much determined by which industry that they're going down.
Right.
But I think what's unique in crypto is that I think that rabbit hole is much more diverse in terms of disciplines than a lot of other technologies. It's amazing how much you do need to learn about economics, governance, law, accounting, and so on, because we're kind of building little economies in a lot of these startups.
Yep.
And it's almost like you need all of those disciplines to fit it all together. So there's no easy answer to that question.
And nobody has everything, do they? No one is an expert at everything.
Can I just elaborate on that a bit, Peter? Because I think the Darcy's point about building economies is sort of something that we were predisposed to see. So we're kind of, you know, we're economists, but we're a particular type of economist, sort of Austrian institutional economist. So when we look at an economy, what we see is not just, you know, production processes and machines and technology and capital and whatever. We see transactions and coordination and a whole lot of just economic value being created by facilitating trades, facilitating, you know, and that sort of economic infrastructure of, you know, counterparty identity, the role of money, the role of sort of contract security, the role of just overcoming a whole lot of trust issues that sometimes are solved by government, sometimes they're solved by only trading with your friends or people in the same company as you, just people that you know, social technologies. Those things don't necessarily tend to scale. And when we sort of first stumbled upon crypto, we didn't see money. We didn't sort of see a cryptocurrency and get obsessed with that. What we got obsessed with was the sort of smart contract side of it.
Right.
Where what we were dealing with here was a new technology for business that could create value by basically enabling high trust, low contact counterparty trade. And I don't need to know who you are in order to safely, securely trade with you.
Yeah.
And the, you know, our sort of central insight was, you know, we'll probably talk about this later, sort of around innovation commons, around sort of pooling of information about value discovery, opportunity discovery. But the other core insight was just that what blockchain technologies do was that they lowered the cost of trust. And that's just that's a cost of economic, you know, of creating economic value. And if a cost goes down, you can create, do more of a thing, the demand curve slope downwards. And that was our initial insight that this is why this is good, why this technology will create value, why this is transformative, why there's all sorts of opportunities there. But those opportunities weren't around sort of better, faster, cheaper products. It was around better, faster, cheaper coordination or organization or facilitation of trade. And that was what we were, you know, in terms of the value discovery, we were sort of trying to help people figure out, you know, how do I make money out of this technology? Mm-hmm. It's trying to, the insight was, okay, where can we reduce costs in a business? And it wasn't so much a business making stuff. It was a trade infrastructure or a trade network or a, you know, economic cooperation, people coming together to do stuff. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. And we saw that very clearly. And it was sort of striking how few others did. And they were sort of seeing, you know, we had a lot of sort of situations where we're dealing with firms that come to us and, you know, often big corporations and go, look, how can we implement blockchain in our company? Mm-hmm. And just right at the front, you know, that was the wrong question.
Okay.
The right question was, how does this technology create value?
Yeah.
And it does so by facilitating trade, facilitating contracting, enabling economic interaction to just be done.
It's a little, I think there's an element of, and it's happening with AI now. So you've got to include in a paper, if a pitch or whatever, and we're using AI, like, because suddenly that signals that you're at the nosebleed. And I think what I'm hearing from you, Jason, is, you know, the tail's wagging dog a little bit when they come at it from, we want to use blockchain. Well, you know, where is the value? What is it exactly you're trying to achieve? And is this appropriate for you? But I'd also speculate that there's an audacity that you need, and you guys sound, particularly that you came into this, you know, so many years ago, setting up the innovation hub, the blockchain innovation hub. It's an audacious move, right? It's an audacious move from a career perspective. It's an audacious move from a professional. How do you explain it to your friends and family, sort of stuff? You know, what are you doing? Oh, you know, I don't know. So when you come at a business, and I've bumped into this several occasions in my career, you know, how big do you want to bite and how hard do you want to chew in terms of, and how long do you want to endure before you can actually discover the innovation or discover the thing that's going to give you the commercial opportunity or the opportunity to add value, whether it's commercial or not, but somehow that you've got something that's got utility, it's got some sort of competitive advantage. Is that, does that line up with what you're saying? you know, is that what you're seeing? Or does everyone come out and say, look, you know, we just want to bolt on blockchain because we reckon we can, you know, however they frame it, because we're going to save 2% on our you know, our costs, and therefore that, you know.
Yeah, we saw a lot of that, and we continue to see a lot of that. But I think that our sort of realization was that the challenge here is, you know, like all new general purpose technologies, it's not just blockchain. We saw this, and we're seeing this currently with Gen AI. We saw it with crypto blockchain. Previously, if we'd been around in earlier generations, we would have seen this in, you know, the invention of the transistor or the electricity or whatever. These technologies don't come fully labeled. It's, you know, they're physical technologies that do stuff, but there's no economic value in it. The economic value is figuring out how to make them useful.
Right.
And that's a discovery process. Mm-hmm. And that discovery process, you know, sometimes the engineers or the physicists or the whatever chemists or whatever will have some insight into, oh, we could use my new thing for this.
Yep.
But mostly that's, you know, that's the entrepreneurial process is a discovery process of having a conjecture about, here's how I think this will create value, and then trying that. And many times there's some missing assumptions in that, or there's missing information, and then other entrepreneurs will see that and then have another go at it.
So it's solving the problem.
It's an evolutionary process.
So knowing the problem that you're, so having a clear idea of what the problem is that you're trying to solve,
having a conjecture about what the problem you think you're trying to solve is. I mean, this is where the market is a selection mechanism that will test your conjectures and hypotheses. Often your conjectures and hypotheses are quite complex and contain lots of different sub conjectures that you're making about the nature of the thing, and these are the costs, and this is the value, and da 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 da. And any business is a bundle of those conjectures. Some or all of them, you know, can be right or wrong.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's the sort of evolutionary, entrepreneurial, Austrian institutional perspective on the nature of where does value come from.
Yeah.
And a new technology, the thing that a new general purpose technology does is it disrupts old truths about business models, about sources of value, and so on. And, you know, we're still, you know, 15 years into with crypto. Blockchain, 15 years into just trying to figure out, testing what is still true, what is not true, what value opportunities.
It's also interesting thinking about the size of the firm. I think this process is very different in a corporate or an existing business with existing rules and systems and processes compared to the startup that is willing to go full crypto from day one and build it in. Yep. And we had this initial view that we thought we were going to be teaching large corporates how to integrate into the blockchain economy. And they were much slower in that regard, that, you know, they had little teams thinking about it and so on. Where the big changes come from were from small startups, teams, often young teams who don't necessarily know how business processes work, who don't even go to that initial thinking of, okay, but who's the director of this thing? What are the legal liabilities here and so on? You needed to be naive on some level to do some of these audacious things. And that was super exciting. It's where we saw a huge amount of the innovation that happened. I mean, if we talk about, so in 2020, we had decentralized finance or DeFi summer, where there were these massive new projects created, new financial primitives. That didn't happen in a bank. That didn't happen in an existing firm. This innovation happened because effectively they ignored all the regulatory system. They ignored existing processes and went out and said, okay, how would we create a decentralized exchange? And went from there. And it's just it's almost the innovator's dilemma in some ways, that these small teams with a little bit naive can go out there and disrupt the big players, and then the big players follow after that.
Yeah, I read something recently where there was a student in a maths class, the lecturer was drolling on, and he lost consciousness. He fell asleep. Woke up just as the lecturer said, and these are the two, maths problems, and left it at that. He basically said something like that. So the student interpreted that as, I've got to go away and solve these. So he went away and he solved one of them. And he came back and he said, look, I've done the work. I've solved this problem. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, the problems that you gave us. No, they were the problems that were unsolvable. So they were the problems that were unsolvable. You can't solve them. He goes, well, here it is. I did it. And lo and behold, he had done it because he hadn't set himself that limitation. And there's kind of a bit of a line between, you know, the corporations and the contained thinking, because we want control. But it's those that are outside that space that just are staggering through the forest of confusion and then suddenly see something and say, hey, oh yeah, this is.
Yeah, and there are a huge number of problems like that in crypto, right? Whenever you work with a small startup team on this, you very quickly come into problems of, okay, assume pseudonymous identity, right? So we don't know who anyone is, including people in our own team, right? So we're often working globally. We're trying to pay people in this digital money that goes up and down and try to build all of this almost in... Well, in the frontier, right, it feels like a wild west of building new types of institutions. Not a wild west in a bad way, but in a way of, okay, there's no identity layer. We're going to build that. There's no way to bridge across these two ecosystems. Well, we need to figure out a way to build a bridge or a stable coin. And we just see this rapid process of innovation in institutions, in rules that we haven't seen before on this scale.
Yeah, so that rapid innovation that we're seeing on the crypto side is one thing, but the flip side of this is also what's happening on the sort of TradFi or, you know, the supply chain side, where what you have in most mature industries with relatively developed technologies, and, you know, large and efficient and so on, is just enormous legacy institutions and often technical debt and infrastructure. And you see that sort of very clearly in banking, for instance. So, you know, banking is a vast global multi-trillion dollar, you know, industrial system. Right at the base of it are a whole bunch of COBOL programs that haven't been changed since the 1960s because they can't. Like everything else is built on top of it.
Right.
And that's the same with sort of regulations and so on, that you have these sort of systems that, you know, it's not that we don't want to upgrade them and fix them. We just can't. They're so deep, so rococo, and so. And one of the arguments that I've increasingly coming to sort of quite like about, you know, what does DeFi, for instance, do? Is it's not just a new sort of digital way of building financial infrastructure institutions. It's also a way of basically correcting all the technical debt that is accumulated. By just having a way to start again. And there's no way you can, you know, there's no way that any of the big banks could sort of go, okay, we're gonna sort of refactor all our code from start. They just can't. That cannot happen.
This episode is sponsored by 3P Legal. I've been a customer of Peter North as my lawyer and now 3P Legal for over a decade. Peter and his team are friendly and approachable, which takes the stress out of having to navigate the complexities of legal business matters. Whether starting a business, buying or selling a business, handling contracts or estate planning, their personalized attention and quality of work is second to none. Find Peter and his team at www.3pcorp.com.au or email pnorth@3plegal.com.au if you need commercial or personal legal services, particularly if you're a startup. But they'd be building the same thing again. There's no outside the box thinking. Yeah. So we're going to go to a decentralized, open, you know, source environment. Sorry, Jason.
And I think this is something we've been particularly fascinated with. Was this question of, you know, how do you do a tech upgrade on an industry where a lot of that tech upgrade, with sort of a lot of energy systems, we're seeing a lot of regulatory pushes to try and force that these are the new regulatory requirements that you have to meet, and that kind of forces the new techs that coming in to meet that. By so you can have regulatory push on it. You can have sort of entrepreneurial push where, you know, the companies with the best tech will try and buy the other companies up, and then they'll integrate it all. And that was the hope with supply chains that we would have supply chain digital upgrades by sort of some big companies buying little companies and then imposing that. But then they run into competition policy or monopoly problems there.
Right.
So tech upgrade of industry infrastructure is an incredibly difficult thing to do. Governments can try their best to push it through. Big companies can try their best to integrate it. And what we're sort of seeing with blockchain tech, smart contracts, is just another, a third way where you just, you're not burning everything to the ground. You're just building a new pathway, and people can gradually migrate to the new pathway.
But it's those layers. Yeah. It's those layers where it's like building the railway infrastructure, but it's a volunteer group of people building the railway and then putting your cabooses across the top.
And now we can even, we're even seeing this in physical infrastructure, right? So there's this big push at the moment into DPIN, or decentralized private infrastructure network. So this is essentially using cryptocurrency as a reward to incentivize people to buy some physical hardware. So some node that will run wireless connections or pick up low range physical objects nearby. We've got hundreds of thousands of these physical nodes across the world now, picking up wire and sending and transmitting wireless communication, because those people were incentivized and paid in crypto. So it's almost, we've gone and done a lot of the digital stuff, and we're still working on that, but now we're seeing more and more push into the physical world to build decentralized private infrastructure.
Are you talking like I've got a Raspberry Pi that runs a Bitcoin node, Umbral Bitcoin node, and that Bitcoin node, and a few. Are you talking about those sorts of things, or are you talking about something else?
So there are a few different ones. So one of the big successful ones is called Helium, which is a wireless communication network.
Right.
There is a cryptocurrency underpinning that incentivized people to spend $1,000 or a couple of $1,000 on this physical node, and then pay them as they transmit data.
Right.
And we've got the same sort of thing going for file storage. So instead of storing with Dropbox or whoever you're storing with,
IPFS ways type
to incentivize.
Thing.
Ways to incentivize. Now it's actually infrastructure as well.
Yep.
So there's sort of this stack of infrastructure being built out, from money, identity, contracting, property rights, file storage. And you start to see how that looks like the institutions of an economy, right?
Well, what's interesting about it is it's decentralized infrastructure that's solving this problem of, you know, how do you build global scale infrastructure for communications and moving stuff around, or, you know, whatever. Now, traditionally, infrastructure like railways or satellites or roads or ports or stuff, you know, you have to start with $1 billion or more, right?
Yep.
There's no one gets to do that at a small scale. Normally, this is what governments do, because they can tax all the citizens and pull together the huge amounts of finance that's needed to build infrastructure.
Or just print the money.
And the thing about DeFi is that it's a new model where you're breaking it into a coordination problem. What infrastructure should we build, and how do we incentivize it? And then a financing problem, which is, well, instead of having one huge company gather together huge amounts of finance and deploy this to build the infrastructure, what we're going to do is have a protocol that will coordinate thousands or millions of people to come together and build all the parts.
Right.
And it's a new business model for building global infrastructure. And what's incredible is that it's a new business model for building even bigger infrastructure than sort of nation state stuff. This is global scale.
Because incentives are aligned.
Yeah. So, again, what's interesting there is new business models, new entrepreneurial models for innovation in a thing that we thought we'd solve hundreds of years ago, right? Just, you know, governments build infrastructure and they have a company that's regulated, and then you do taxes and whatever to finance that, the old nation state model of infrastructure. Then along comes magical crypto money and completely disrupts all of it in a way that, we're right at the beginnings of that disruption.
So when we're thinking about this stuff, you know, normally, you know, from an innovation entrepreneurship perspective, you go, you know, guy on a couch or guy or girl on a couch with an idea, pop, question, you know, mark, light bulb goes off. Into the garage, they go tinker, 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 bing. It's gone bing. I've got something. And then they open the garage door and they go to the marketplace and go, I want to sell it. Right. So there's
and more that thing is usually a consumer product. They're like, here's a widget that people will want, and they're imagining it as a I'll take it to the shops or the marketplace, and I will sell it to the to the people. Like, and you know, this question of, you know, what is entrepreneurship in crypto? And when, you know, when we having to explain it to our friends and colleagues, they go, but I don't see it in shops. You know, where's the sort of, you know, where's the breakthrough product.
Right.
And this is right there. Let me stop you right there. It's not a product.
Yeah.
It's institutional. It's an institutional technology. Mm. It's not a consumer product. It's not industrial technology. We're not selling paint or cars or songs or whatever.
Right.
We're building economic infrastructure, and all of the sort of entrepreneurial action in crypto right from the start was, Satoshi, here's a new money, or here's a new sort of asset infrastructure. Vitalik, here's a new contracting tool. Infrastructure and institutional infrastructure, and that's why this technology is weird, and I think why just a lot of otherwise smart people have just misunderstood what it is.
Yep.
And I think it's because it's a surprising, most tech doesn't work like that.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
So maybe tell me, either of you, so when someone knocks on your door and comes into the Blockchain Innovation Hub, what happens? You say they're at an idea stage, there might be a prototype stage. What's your mandate? Give me some examples on how you help people.
So often it starts by sitting down in front of a whiteboard and trying to figure out exactly what's going on here. Where is this idea? Does it make a lot of sense, right? Because we've talked about institutions a lot throughout this podcast. Sometimes a company will just work, right? Yeah. And that's the right way to build this particular product or solve this trust problem. And it's not clear that a blockchain is needed in there at all. So a lot of that process at the start is figuring out, well, what trust problem or coordination problem are you trying to solve? Why or should there be a token here or not? Is this sort of community driven or are you trying to do it yourself? And there'll be sort of, we'll do a bunch of different whiteboarding sessions, and see where it goes from there, basically. Every team is different. It looks very different. Some people are coming in with a lot of entrepreneurship experience. They've, they've done a whole bunch of exits already. They might even be closer to the end of their career, and right, they're finally making the plunge into some wild crypto stuff.
Right.
Or it's a very young team who's dropped out of uni because they're obsessed with this as well.
Right.
And often it's the latter that that wins the game.
Yeah,
Jason,
yeah.
I don't know if you want to add any more to that sort of process.
I think the thing, I mean, we love this sort of stuff. It's absolutely just, these are always fun and exciting things to do. But part of it is because the first questions that we're interested in is just, what is the nature of the economic disruption that you're trying to, what are you trying to disrupt? And we usually spend, we spend our initial time just trying to figure that out, trying to understand how value is being created, what types of where is the source of value that will be created or released through this process. And once we can understand that, then we can sort of get a sense of, okay, well, here's the bit that we need to control, or this is the bit that we want to try and bring others in on, or whatever. Which parts do we want open and public? Which parts do we need to close off? And that then becomes the basis for the business model and so on.
So
what we're fundamentally doing is economic design.
Right. Yeah. So do they just scribble away on paper, record the conversation, or do you produce something for them and say, look, here's, where do you stop? Or do they come back every week and you go, okay, enough now, you got it.
Oh, it's an iterative process. Lots of blackboards and coffee and shouting and so on.
Right.
But I mean, I think we see ourselves very much as, we like to come in early on these projects, and we like to sort of see ourselves as contributing to these, to the sorts of processes that are going on here. But this also helps us. I mean, we work for a university. We're in the knowledge creating and knowledge transfer business. So this helps us to understand what we get out of this is we get to learn about the new types of business opportunities and challenges and problems that we're seeing in the space. We can relay that to others in the industry. We can relay that back to students in terms of, look, here's what we're seeing and finding.
Okay.
In partnership with whoever walks through the door, we often figure stuff out, and that then becomes material that we can.
I think it's an invaluable service that you offer, and I think I alluded to the fact that I've got something to talk to you about, which we'll do at another time that's suitable for you. But I wanted to kind of cut the conversation over into the emerging regulations, particularly around the finance industry. These ideas bubbling up and coming in and trying to find a place in the marketplace and go to market. Cart and horse type thing, right? So we off we go. Now I know Darcy. I presume you have too. Jason contributed to some of the information you've been sending to the governments and the Senate committees. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, of course. We've sort of long been involved in the policy space in crypto and other tech, because this is a thing that happens again and again. A new tech comes along, breaks a whole bunch of rules. There's a process where the politicians don't understand it, the departments don't understand it, none of them talk to each other. And the sooner we can get through that, the better. It's good for entrepreneurs, it's good for the economy, and so on. So since, it's probably been 4 years ago, maybe, Australia had a national blockchain roadmap that Jason was involved in. There's also been a bunch of Senate inquiries, multiple Senate inquiries running after each other. There's been Treasury inquiries trying to figure out how do we deal with crypto. So there's this new asset. We're not really sure what it is to start off with. Even to start off with, is it money or is it property? What is it? What bucket do we put it in?
I'm giggling a little bit because, they were trying to get their head around that. They never quite, they sort of started to get there, and then AI rocked up. It was like the bigger guy came in the room and like, we're dealing with this bloke. Now you've turned up with this bloke.
Exactly right. So we've been involved in a bunch of the AI inquiries recently as well, because this process is happening again. But in one of the fundamental problems with crypto and regulation is that our regulatory systems are built to deal with a specific set of institutions, specifically companies and markets, right? And we've got a pretty good idea now of how you regulate a company, right? You come up with some rules, and then when the company doesn't do the thing, you go and knock on the director's door and say, stop doing the thing or we'll put you in jail, right? We know how to do that, and we have an idea of how to regulate markets as well in terms of competition policy and so on. Well, of course, those things are not perfect, but we have an idea. Crypto comes along, decentralized, not very many, there's lack of identity layer, there's no directors. Even if you wanted to shut Bitcoin down, you couldn't. There's all these things that just, we don't even know how to start to grapple it. So where we're at in Australia at the moment, after several inquiries, we're hopefully in the next year or so going to take some of the low-hanging fruit of the crypto industry and regulate centralized exchanges. So centralized exchanges where people go and buy crypto and trade crypto, not the decentralized parts of the crypto economy, but the centralized parts. And essentially at this point, the proposal is to use existing financial services licenses and apply them to centralized exchanges.
Right.
Now, this makes sense to me. There are custody problems. Someone is holding an asset on your behalf, and they may do things with that asset that you don't want them to. Mm-hmm. They might lose it. They might, as we've seen, they might go and invest it and lose it, a whole bunch of things. It makes sense to me in these centralized parts of the crypto economy, basically the on-ramps that our existing regulatory systems can apply. That's the low-hanging fruit, and we're getting there. We're slowly getting there. I'm not very confident of what happens as soon as you step off a centralized exchange into the crypto economy, where you have decentralized networks, community-owned organizations, and so on. We'll get to that at some point. In the first time, we're trying to protect consumers, prevent a bunch of scams, do all that sort of stuff through centralized exchanges. But I'm not too confident of where we go into the next stage, because I'm not convinced that a government could ever regulate Uniswap. A decentralized exchange. I just don't see how that could happen. One thing that is starting to happen is we're seeing the legal recognition of decentralized autonomous organizations. So decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAOs, are basically communities on the internet that use blockchain technology to coordinate around something. There's tens of billions of dollars sitting in decentralized autonomous organizations to do a whole range of different things. But they have no legal recognition. They're not a company. So that's a problem for them because they can't really write a contract inside a legal jurisdiction because they have there is no legal entity there. Mm. So some states in the US and elsewhere...
You can't sue them. Has,
essentially. So there's various workarounds that we're working towards. And we'll see that, I'm sure, in Australia in the next maybe couple of years. But I'm not sure where it goes from there.
Yeah, it's that old problem of, you know, incorporations, whose throat do I choke if this goes wrong? Okay, it's Jason or it's Darcy or it's Peter. This is a completely different beast. Do you think with some of the regulations there's a conflict of, I don't know what the right word is, but the conflict of interests where I'm regulating, I as the government am regulating something that is in effect threatening my the reason for me to exist is because yes. I operate in a centralized world and yeah. I'm regulating something that is threatening the my ability to earn a living, you know, to have a place. Yeah,
that's particularly true for institutional technologies because the main producer of institutional technologies is usually the government.
Right.
Government and its friends that it contracts to produce them. So the classic example of that is military contracting, where you've got a government raising the funding for it, and then a small but select group of large friends that build all the equipment. I mean, the broader question here, and again, this is sort of something that we're, you know, the types of economists that we're particularly alert to this, is the question of who benefits from regulation, mm-hmm. What is regulation for, and the standard answer as well. Regulation is to prevent harm from unscrupulous corporations from harming gullible consumers and citizens, and the government stands there and protects the citizens from the evil corporations. And you know, there's some truth in that. But the by far the main beneficiary of regulation is existing incumbent corporations being protected from competition.
Yep, absolutely.
Banks love regulation because it raises the costs of new firms starting up, you know, becoming a bank. First, they have to get a license, and those licenses are restricted. And
yeah, barriers to entry.
So, when you see it that way, the beneficiaries of regulation are existing corporations because they can, you know, they can basically lock in their business by they can legislate their business model. Mm-hmm. Their business model becomes written into legislation and regulation such that they have a comparative advantage in running the business with that business model, whether it's branch banking or whatever, and using that technology. So you end up, and this is sort of the reason that we're sort of quite heavily involved in regulatory reform, is that regulatory reform, from our perspective, often a major purpose of regulatory reform is to facilitate innovation by just basically breaking up the existing regulations that are holding back or to locking in business models and raising the costs of new technologies, just to either to create a more level playing field in competitive new technologies. And we're seeing this, you know, like that's at the core of what is happening with DeFi versus TradFi. We'll see it again with AI and say consulting or AI and just, you know, all of the sort of disruption that's coming up. So a lot of AI regulation around privacy and other types of things is really, you know, in some respects, is just cover for protecting existing business models and existing capital, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot at stake here around large capital investments that could be devalued by new technology. So, you know, innovation and new technology is, you know, it's great, it's good, but it's massively disruptive and costly if you have existing capital that's embedded in old technologies that's about to be rapidly destroyed. And, you know, so, you know, we have a situation where part of the function of politics is to sort of launder that transition. And you know, enable new technologies to pay off old technologies and effectively buy them out, and that's a political process.
I guess the other complexity must also be we don't operate in a silo. So America's doing stuff, the Europeans are doing stuff, the Brits are doing stuff.
Well, that's the other big new thing. So the one of the reasons that we've been actively trying to campaign and work and help Australia to develop high quality world class crypto regulation is that we're in competition with other jurisdictions, and this is an opportunity for these are internet type things. They don't exist in countries; they exist on the
in the cybersphere. Yeah.
And regulation doesn't become just a way that a government, a state, controls its citizens. It's actually have to compete with other regulatory jurisdictions for inbound capital, for inbound technologies and other ideas, or exit to sort of mitigate or minimize that. And what we now have is a surprising, interesting world of competitive regulation. The bigger you are as a country, the less you have to worry about that. But countries like Australia or Singapore or even Japan are sort of realizing this is a huge global opportunity to sort of see high quality regulation as an opportunity to bring in advanced technologies and jobs and other types of socially beneficial things to their citizens.
Who's doing it right? You mentioned Singapore. Who's at the leading edge of actually enabling innovation and entrepreneurship in the decentralized world? Who are you liking?
Look, if it's
El Salvador, I hear it doing so.
That's the most interesting thing, Jason. This is genuinely changing from month to month, right? You go to a crypto conference somewhere in Asia, for instance, and one year the leader was Singapore, and you go back the next year and everyone's talking about Japan or Dubai or wherever it happens to be. It's also because it depends what type of business or industry the particular project is in. So they're all tackling different things. If you want to go and register a DAO, a lot of people would say, we'll go to particular states in the US. States in the US, to be clear, which is one of the key things we're seeing across the board is it tends to be smaller jurisdictions that can move faster.
Florida, Texas.
Or are willing to make those bets to put through a bill because there are risks inherent in regulating any new tech. I just want to go back quickly to a point that Jason made as well. One of the key things that we contribute to the policy debates in Australia is around defining what that regulatory perimeter is. So there was a push towards regulating centralized exchanges. A lot of our contributions were, okay, make sure not decentralized exchanges. Say that is not what you're regulating so that you don't kill off all of this tail of entrepreneurs in Australia who are doing this. Mm-hmm. And to add to another point that Jason had as well is that one of the conversations we often get asked, aside from who's the leader, is essentially how many jobs or which company blockchain companies are in Australia? That's a question that politicians want to know. They want to know how many jobs there are, how much economic activity there is. And the challenge we have is that these are decentralized, often team-built products that maybe you've got 5 people in Australia who are contributing to a multi-billion dollar protocol, but you don't really know where those perimeters are. Often those people want to be anonymous.
Right.
So it's a hard political argument to make compared to a lot of other industries because you can't draw a line around it and say this is how valuable it is. This is what electorate it's in.
That's a good point. But it's like Jeff Booth's argument as well. Technology, these sorts of things are job destroyers. You don't need as many people digging the hole as you did. The shovel came out, the backhoe came out, and now you can get a robot building the thing. You don't have anybody necessarily. It was suggested to me that in the not too distant future we will see the first one person unicorn that just surrounds themselves with I don't know if you agree with that, a $1 billion company run by one person.
It sounds like Michael Saylor to me.
Yeah, It might have been. So what is there something, I guess that, this, I guess we're going through this transitional sort of phase. Is there something we're not talking about? Is there something in the space that really is going to catch us?
But I think the thing that we're not talking about enough is just the why this is good. And the simple, clear answer is that most government infrastructure in the world is horrible. You know, we're truly blessed here in Australia that we have, you know, we have relatively good government that has been, you know, been for, you know, over a century, has been building high quality infrastructure, and it's, you know, we're okay. Most of the world isn't like that,
right?
And most of the world lacks just basic identity infrastructure, or money transfer infrastructure, or just you know, a whole lot of things like that. And, you know, there's Elon Musk for putting satellites all around the world, and now, you know, now we've got you know, we've got internet in space, and what that means is that wherever you are in the world, you can get the internet. That's, you know, that took a private company to do that,
right?
Because there is no government at global scale that is responsible for that, and, you know, hopefully there never will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, so okay, so but we, so it's this just bringing on board the other 6 billion.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about that occasionally in the past, at different, you know, moments in crypto, about, you know, unbanking the banking the unbanked and so on. But that really is it, right? This is the ability to bring on just everyone on Earth at a level of just you get to participate in the global economy on an equal level, regardless of where you were born.
I guess there's,
that's an incredible thing to do.
It is. I couldn't agree more. I did a recording yesterday with a lady called Valini Jacobs out of Vanuatu, who supports, you know, small agricultural developing economy entrepreneurs, particularly female entrepreneurs in Vanuatu. I spent some time in Vanuatu, and to your point, Jason, when I was there, I went there twice. My partner was over there for work. I was astounded at the poor quality internet there, and I said, "Why aren't you guys just getting Elon's, you know, dishes and just rolling them out?" Well, the government, the lens in which the government looks, and there's plenty of corruption. There's plenty of problems in the South Pacific, and also the geopolitical issues that they're facing. You know, they're trying to control the world. So it's basically, you know, two telcos in the area, and the government is still saying if Elon's going to deliver his packages here, he needs to do it in partnership with the local companies, and they need to. Whereas I could just arrive with it in a bag, slung over my shoulder, and just go through and go, "Oh, this is a computer." Yeah, it's just a computer.
This really is a substantial break in how we change institutions in developing economies, right? So I think this is underappreciated, that what we know that institutions and the rule systems of an economy are incredibly important for entrepreneurs, for prosperity, for growth, for all these things. So you're stuck with some corrupt or bad institutions. How do you change them? Well, you can try and convince the politicians who have the entrenched interests in those systems to change them. Unlikely to work. You can take over the country and put your institutions in that country. That's one way that
you'd like us to invade Vanuatu. Okay,
you can.
Not advocating revolution there, just to be clear.
you can beg the government to say, "We want a special economic zone over here."
Right.
So we're going to create this separate area, and it's going to have different rules. You can keep all of your entrenched interests, but let's just see how the common law goes over here, and whether it prospers or not. All of those things are often violent, bad. They take a long time. That's not necessarily what we want to do. Now we have a situation where you're in a developing economy. Your money is inflating rapidly. You want to sign a contract with someone. You can take your pick of a stable coin. Instead of going to the corrupt court down the road, you can have a smart contract with decentralized dispute resolution. To set up your company, you can create a decentralized autonomous organization without moving. And it's not just incredible for those people who are doing it individually, but I think what we're about to see is a big wave of pressure back onto those political systems to change the institutions for everyone and we're starting to see that.
Let me sharpen this up. So 20th century entrepreneurship and innovation was mostly about entrepreneurs coming up with products to sell to rich people, more or less. Rich people means the sort of first world. 21st century entrepreneurship and innovation is people coming up with new infrastructure to sell to the rest of the world. And that's, you know, Satoshi was the first, you know, 21st century entrepreneur in that sense. And we're seeing more and more of this. Like, I think this is this passion, you know. Now, you don't necessarily start by building a company and raising finance. You get a white paper and you launch a DAO or whatever. You know, like the mechanics of how you do this are a bit different. But it's also whom you're serving and what you're building here. This is the sort of thing that a few centuries ago, if you wanted to do this, you would try and conquer a country and right. colonize it or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, now, you know, thankfully, we don't need to do that. We can just you know, build infrastructure. And if people use it, great.
Yep.
Up to them. This is the sort of peaceful global transition to building a global economy, not through the World Bank or, you know, various other corporate or you know, empire-ish ways, but actually through entrepreneurship and innovation. Grassroots, just build something. If people use it, the world, you know, that's how we grow economies.
Sure.
And it's incredible. And that's entrepreneurship and innovation in the 21st century, and it's a digital stack. It's, you know, crypto, smart contracts, blockchains are the foundation of that, but, you know, it's running on the internet. That internet is held together with satellites and computers. AI comes along and just powers that up. You know, the stack is starting to get deeper and deeper, and there's a surprising amount of open source in that stack.
Oh yeah.
It's you know, like, this is what we're excited about. This, and I think this is, you know, how we sort of see the, you know, the goal and purpose of the Blockchain Innovation Hub is we're building a new economy, and we're building it not in Australia. We're building it at a global, you know, planetary scale here. And it does look and feel a bit different in terms of, you know, the way it's done. But fundamentally, what is still there is that this is a job. This is, you know, entrepreneurship and innovation are what are driving this.
What a wonderful point at which to stop this. I think you know, that kind of encapsulates you know, I guess the you know, your mandate, I guess, as an organization. Would you like to say I guess, you know, leave listeners on how to find you and you know, how to engage with the hub?
Of course, we're on the internet, so we have a website, RMIT blockchain.io, but we also what we try and do, which is different to the standard academic process, is we like to tweet a lot. We like to write a lot of Medium posts. So you probably best to find us on Twitter or X, whatever we're calling it now. X, I believe. We're all on Twitter, and we try to put out as many ideas and keep it as open as possible, rather than waiting for an article come out in 2 years or however long it takes. So please reach out on any channels. And we love to chat with anyone and everyone in the crypto or related spaces in Australia.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I can't thank you enough. This has been extraordinary. I love this space. I hope we can do it again. There's a lot to unpack here. We could have gone, probably half my page of things I wanted to talk about. We probably, but I'm conscious of your time as well. Thank you so much. I'm going to email you that other thing that I want to sit at the table with you and carve out a little bit of your brain power. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I will hopefully have you on again.
Thanks, Peter. Absolutely, a pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Jason and Darcy. I know I did. Feel free to email us your comments at hello@entrepreneurship.au. And until next time, stay safe and stay curious.